Make sure you check out our online store where we work with our graphic designer to create stunning garment and product designs that feature a wide variety of aircraft types such as British fighters, World War II aircraft, American bombers, Russian fighters and much more. You can pick your favourite designs and personalise any items within our Redbubble store that range from clothing right the way through to stationery. All of our designs feature our logo, so you can show your support for the channel while getting a quality product. You can head to our website aircrewinterview.tv and click store, or go to redbubble.com/people/ACInterview. Thank you and enjoy. Tell us what happened after your USAF exchange before you went on to 92, if you can briefly tell us about that.
I was extraordinarily lucky, Mike. I got another flying tour as a squadron leader. I went on to Air Defence and did just over, or just under a year with 56 Squadron in the Air Defence role. 56 was taking over from Lightnings in the Air Defence role within 11 Group, and I went in there as a flight commander. So it was back to an aeroplane I knew, but into a role that was nowhere near as much fun as hurling yourself at the ground and firing weapons and bombs. Basically, it was air defense, pure and simple. It was fun. It was flying. I wasn't about to sneeze at it, but I'd rather have been doing ground attack.
And we're here to, part two is going to be about your time on 92, because you went on to command the squadron. So tell us how this came about, Black.
I'd given up trying to get onto the Harrier.
Still trying, though.
I was in London. I'd been in London doing two consecutive tours in the MOD. And I wanted to, obviously, I'd love to have commanded a squadron. But I wanted to go back to flying single-seaters. So I kept asking to be commander of a Jaguar squadron. And I got a Phantom squadron. And I got 92. Which was it couldn't have been better in that sense, because it was a low-level air defense squadron. And it was a squadron with a magnificent history. So I remember vividly, my boss at the time was an Air Vice Marshal, Paddy Hine, who'd been the boss of 92. And I was walking through the corridor of MOD when I bumped into him and the Vice Chief of the Air Staff, who I expected just have to leaned against the wall and let them pass me by. But Paddy stopped, introduced me to Sir John Nicholl, as it was, and said, or John Nicholls, and said, "This lucky chap's going to go and take over 92. Aren't you lucky, Black?" And I said, "Am I, sir? Thanks very much." And it was a squadron with a reputation, so I felt incredibly lucky and proud to be going there.
Yeah, I've talked to, you probably know a couple of guys I've interviewed, RPE, David Gledhill, they always say that's an amazing squadron. So just give us a brief history about what the squadron and why it was so prolific, or is still, I guess, in a way, with the RAF.
I think you have to come at this from two directions. Firstly, the history before I'd taken over, and then secondly, what happened when I was there. The history first. 92 was the highest scoring fighter outfit during World War II. It was commanded by people whose names, and I use this word advisedly, were legends in the Spitfire world. Brian Kinkham, yeah. Bob Stanford Tuck, Jamie Rankin. And it had a fantastic reputation as being aggressive, not just good at the job, but they were a band of brothers, to pick a phrase out of the air, with amazing, amazing spirit. So I knew I was inheriting something special. What I wasn't ready for when I got to the squadron was to suddenly realize I was in command of the squadron that was the highest scoring fighter outfit since World War II, because I inherited the crew who'd shot down an RAF tank. Yeah. So my first, three or four weeks were sorting out that how we deal with a court-martial on the squadron. I can come back in more detail if you want. But the second part of the answer is, why was it so good? It's a mixture of the people, and I inherited some brilliant people, and I had some equally brilliant people posted in. And we made it a huge amount of fun. A couple of ways we did that. once I'd got through the trauma, which it was for the squadron in a way, of doing a court-martial, I realized we weren't getting enough flying, so I challenged the engineers to give us more flying, because flying equals fun, and squadrons are supposed to be fun. So I had a very good engineer and a very good team of engineers, and they said, well, we can do that, but it means doing a few things first. So if you give us 2 or 3 months, then we'll give you more flying. And they juggled airplane servicing schedules, and they gave me the more flying bit. And then secondly, we got a lot of DACT, and we had a small team, a four-ship team, that traveled around Europe doing the odd display, and that made it fun too. So it was just the most fun you'd have with your clothes on.
Absolutely. So was the squadron basically air-to-air, that's it? There was no air-to-ground or reconnaissance at all?
There was no air-to-ground, but there was low-flying, which was really important. The low-level air defence role was much more challenging because you've got Germany weather, which is not much different from the UK's in a way. A lot of cloud, rain, mist, limited visibility. So flying at low level in Germany was akin to being almost in the ground attack role. And that was really exhilarating. And the DACT bit, when you're doing it at somewhere like Dechi, where you've got a range, is one thing. You couldn't do DACT at low level, but you could do engagements whereby people came to attack a target which you defended, and you'd obviously have to try and take out the Jaguars or the Harriers. First of all, find them as they're coming in at low level, and secondly, shoot them down, in quotes. Same thing that the guys did when they shot down the Jaguar. I mean, you do it without a live weapon. You put the sights on, you get the right sort of growl from the practice missile, and you know you've found the target.
Mm-hmm. So what was the main threat at the time you were commanding from the Russians? Would it have been like MiG-29s or MiG-27s, anything like that, 23s?
Yeah, those were 27s certainly were around, but when you're looking at what our main threat was, I don't think, I personally didn't consider the threat per se, because rather like, again, World War II, what shoots you down is what you can't see. What I was worried about was a missile being fired head on. I mean, we had head on missiles, they had head on missiles. It doesn't matter what it is, if it's out of sight, when it fires that missile at you. So in terms of knowing what the threat was, we could do our aircraft recognition. We knew what the airplane threats were. But the real threats were that the Soviet forces would cross the border, take over Berlin. I mean, Berlin was at the end of a long corridor.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stuff we trained for was protecting Berlin. I mean, 48, the corridor was established to do the Berlin airlift. We still practiced having to defend Berlin in that way. And you could almost sit at Gatow and look at Soviet people just over the hill, as it were. So that was the threat. The threat was the Russian hordes, as it were, taking over part of northern Germany. And to me, the worries weren't what's going to shoot at me, what missiles have they got, was would our defensive system stand up to the threat? Would the comms all work? Would the plans all work? And that's why we had Takibar to test that to the maximum. And I was never a great one to worry about who the guy is that's shooting at me. It's can we do the job? Because the job is now different because it's all part of a controlled system working to a plan.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like it was actually going to go in quotes hot here when you were over there?
When you say going hot, I mean, a live threat, I don't think we ever thought there were. Yes, we trained as if there was going to be one, but it never to me felt, it felt much more dangerous and much more real, much hotter, if you like, doing Takibar than it did day to day. And I take my hat off to NATO and the Takibar system at the time. I believe that in the 80s, RAF Germany was as ready as anyone in the world to take on the Soviet threat, as well trained, as well versed in procedures, We took it incredibly seriously. Gas masks, all those sort of things, most unpleasant. But that gave me confidence that if we had to go to war, we as a squadron and RAF Germany as a unit and 2ATAF as an organization was up to the job. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that answers your question, but it's the best I can do.
Well, absolutely, it does. But did you personally have any close encounters with any, you know, Eastern Bloc aircraft?
I'm going to make you laugh because the only one I've ever seen for live was a helicopter when I'd left the Air Force then. I was going into the Czech Republic. I'd just gone to visit a friend who was on the embassy staff there. We'd gone through the checkpoint. I'd got a back seat full of, I got an old Shogun with 96 bottles of wine in the back for the guy who wanted red wine I was going to see. And as we came through the checkpoint, they would, you have to visualize this, a straight road, tall trees, a bit like Germany, pines, and out of the trees on my left, at a rocket ship pace, at the top of the trees, came a camouflaged hind.
Ooh.
And it was the biggest shock of my life. I didn't expect to see it. It was that close, and it was a Polish, but it looked like a Russian hind, and it was, as tall and intents and purposes. And another thing that, you know, surprises you more than that, when you see it's the opposition. The Cold War had finished, but it still made my heart flutter. So that's the only time I've got close to a Russian airplane.
Yeah, you mentioned DSET before, but would you ever practice, you know, with the Americans, you know, the other NATO countries?
Yeah, on 92 we did quite a lot. I'll cover the UK first of all. We flew against Sea Harriers, which was quite fun. We flew against F-15s, we flew against F-5s. And that was all done down at Decimamanu on the range there, which took the the screaming, shouting debrief out of context. And yeah. Everything, you couldn't argue your point. There were the facts. Someone could say, I shot you down because it's there in, I was going to say in black and white, it's there in electronics. So, and that was huge fun.
So what were the rules, or was there any strict rules and restrictions flying in Germany in the Phantom at that time?
Yes, it was different. It was different in that the Cold War was coming to an end, even though it hadn't come to an end. The Germans were more concerned about noise, so overflying German towns. You can imagine four F-4s engaging with four Harriers over a small German town makes an awful lot of noise.
I can imagine. Beautiful noise.
So we got a thing called the Battle of Coesfeldt occurred when I was there, and we got banned from flying too close to sensitive towns, and that's pretty reasonable. I mean, I've got to say that they've got a point. So low level, we had to be careful. So the restrictions were, you couldn't fly at 250 feet everywhere where you could in the UK. And then flying at high level, you couldn't go supersonic because of the noise again. And also there were restrictions on altitude because the airspace was broken down a bit like it was in America, in a much more constrained way than it was in the UK. So it felt restricted.
So how many jets were actually on the squadron when you were commanding the 92?
12. We had 12 squadron airplanes.
So how many crews would that be? Would you have, would every pilot and nav be synced together, or would the, mix and match?
You'd hope to have 1.5, i.e. 18, and sometimes crews went down to 1.3 or 1.2 to 1. You tried to fly people as crews ideally, because you work up, it's like you and I talk long enough, we develop a rapport. Yeah. You develop a rapport with the guy in the back seat. So you tried to fly people together. You mix and match. A young guy would come in, a young pilot. You give him an experienced navigator, and vice versa. If an experienced navigator came in, give him a young pilot to come along with. And also, I tried to fly with everybody at some stage, although I have my own nav. I tried to fly with everybody, and I flew in the back seat with everybody at some stage or other too, being qualified to do so. I wanted to find out how people flew, how competent they were. I mean, they're all competent, but you get a much better feel. Even if you just sit in the back and talk for an hour with a guy, you get to know him better. You've got nowhere else to go.
Exactly. I think that's what a good boss does as well, get to know the people you're working with. And, yeah, again, here, Black, you probably have plenty of stories from your time on 92, but do you have one that sticks out in your mind that you can share with our viewers?
I've got to tell you one that I'm afraid is against me. It's to do with DACT. We were at Deche Mamanu, and Ron Cook was my navigator, and we were going to get airborne with a guy called Andy Cairncross, who often flew as my number two. And we were doing a thing called 2v2v2 against two F-15s and two F-5 aggressors.
Wow.
Now, as Andy Cairncross got to the end of the runway, his airplane went US. Oh. So they're now 2v2v1. So I know I'm in trouble right from the start. So we entered the arena, and we don't know where the other guys are. And my pulse is going at a very fast rate, and I thought I better enter with as much speed as I can get. So Ron Cook, brilliant navigator, found one of the F-15s, and we took him out with a Sparrow, and he was removed from the fight because the guys controlling it on the ACI range, that's a fair kill. We moved on to the second, we took out one of the F-5s, we took out the other F-5, and we took out one of the F-15s. Wow. At this stage, Ron Cook's been playing a blinder in the back seat. I've got three confirmed kills, but I've got an F-15 out there who's after my ass. And I am mildly concerned. At this stage, I thought the only way to do it is to get out of this now before I get shot down. So I'd got full throttle, I was a full afterburner, and headed out of the arena. That's the only way out. Mm-hmm. At that moment, a whole bunch of bright lights came on, which these bright lights say you have 2,000 pounds of fuel left. Uh-oh. Now, that's not a lot of fuel.
No.
I was in afterburner, and what was more, I was heading the wrong way. I was heading north, and where I had to get to was to the south. So I came out of afterburner, got as high as I could, and just set the throttles to use as little fuel as possible, and headed back for base. A large thing is puzzled. What are you going to do now, Robertson? Because you really screwed this up. So what I did was to get hold of the guy in the control tower at Deche, who was a chap we took along with us to help out with problems in the tower. John Wells, lovely man. John, I've got a fuel problem. What runway are we on? Still the one we took off on? Yes. That would mean I had to fly a very long route to get back. So I said, John, I've got a fuel emergency. Can you get them to turn the runway around the other way so I can land from north to south? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go through any of their routing. I'm going to take a straight line from where I am right now, which is 100 miles north of you with no fuel. Please make it happen. Otherwise, I'm in trouble. And John Wells just said, leave it with me. It took some time. He eventually managed it. Stopped other people flying, which upset everybody. And I managed to land, the wind was only light, so I could land downwind. I had enough fuel to taxi back. Called the squadron together, told them what I'd done, said I was an extremely bad boy, very silly, and I grounded myself. So I was not allowed to fly for the rest of the day. However, after about half an hour, the guy running the detachment said, I need you on the program because you're the only air combat leader I've got left. And if you don't fly, we lose four sorties.
Oh.
So I ungrounded myself and flew. But it was, I embarrassed the hell out of myself, Mike. I've always believed in one thing. You've got to tell the truth. I screwed up. I screwed up in spades. But I suppose, in the end, I respected myself for being honest, and I love John Wells and the control tower for saving my bacon.
Absolutely, yeah. The truth never hurts, so you did the right thing there, surely. What a story. Black, before we move on, how long did you spend on 92 in Germany?
I spent 2 years, and then I went straight to the Falklands.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit about the Falklands. Like, how did that tour come about, and what was it like to fly over there?
It comes about because the squadron was manned, was 23 squadron, and they manned it by taking people from different squadrons for a period of detachment. Mm-hmm. And it was just a 4 or 5 month time running the squadron. So that's how it came about. What it was like to fly out there, two or three things were different. First of all, flying at low level, and we were doing low level intercepts against Harriers, who were also out there, which that was quite good fun. And we did low level refueling with the Hercules. But bear in mind, the visibility was limitless. There was no atmospheric distortion. You could see for miles. So navigating at low level, what looked to be a mile or two away, three or four, was actually 8 or 10. So everybody early on had to learn that that was new. The flying, apart from that, was pretty routine and pretty boring. And our whole raison d'etre was to be on QRA. So that was the second element. We spent all of our time either in kit, ready to be scrambled, or sort of trying to find something to pass the time. Extraordinarily boring. We lived on a boatel. And there wasn't very much to do except go on things like R&R with the Falkland Islanders. And the third thing was seeing the Falklands for themselves was utterly fascinating. I mean, we lived at Stanley, and Stanley was like a sort of Wild West town. I got there just after they put down the new runway. Mm-hmm. There were sort of rub hangars to look after the airplanes. The gym was a couple of ISO containers bored together. It was really pretty basic. And the signs for things were the wooden posts with like Boot Hill on it sort of thing. It really was like a Wild West.
Wow.
And going out and about seeing people in the Falklands was, wildlife was amazing, but going, the thing I remember most of all, going to San Carlos and looking at the place where, that was sort of bomb alley where we lost three naval ships. Coventry was one, I know, Ardent was another, can't think what the third one was. And visiting the cemetery there, you could, from the air you could see the cemetery that the Argentinians had, and there was a cemetery with just 12, 14 graves of the Brits. Really, it made you think. So a huge experience, but some of the most boring flying I've ever done.
Wow. But yeah, it sounds like you had a great career up until then. But if you can tell us like what happened after the Falklands up until the end of your RAF career, that would be great, Black.
Well, I was extraordinarily lucky, really, Mike. I went from the Falklands to command Wattisham, which was my last real dabble at flying regularly. The only flying I got was with the squadrons there. So I had to be nice to people like Cliff Spinker who ran 74.
And, I made a new name before, yes.
Yeah.
Nice
good
guy.
Man. And Ali Mackay ran 56, and then it was taken over by Mike Bruce. And Dick Northcote had 74, so I flew the F4J there. You could kid yourself you were flying operationally, but you weren't. I mean, they gave you experienced navigators, and, you know, I had the experience. But I wasn't flying often enough to be really as competent I'd like to have been.
Right.
And the way I would liken it is, how many Formula One drivers do you see 45 or 50 years old? You don't. But, you know, at that age, I forget how old I was, I must have been well into my 40s. The skills that you had, they atrophied gradually. You see things less well, you react less well, you're not as competent as the young, bright kids. So that was Wattisham. I then went backwards and forwards to MOD. The next really good flying tour was as a two-star out in Germany, when I actually had control of what I could do. I could actually angle to fly. Again, it was a privilege I didn't want to abuse, but the F4s were just going out, so I had the chance to fly my last F4 sortie with Nick Spiller on 19 Squadron. 19 and 92 were at Wildenrath together, and I'd love to have flown my last on 92, but 92 folded before 19 did. Mm. And then I checked out on the Tornado, which Grand Attack, back to, you know, what I was used to, fantastic fun. And I flew the Tornado fairly regularly. Again, I flew with each of the squadrons. I got to look at every squadron. I got to fly with people on all the squadrons. So if you do a high, low, high into the UK, then fly back to Germany, you're in an aeroplane for an hour and a half with a young navigator, or old as they were, probably with me. You get to hear more about life from their point of view. And once they get to know you and understand that you're just a dismembered voice in the front, you're not a two-star, you develop enough of a rapport to understand what life is like on a squadron and on the base. I got to fly the Harrier, and I got to learn to fly the helicopter. I didn't want to abuse my privilege and check out single seat in the Harrier. I'd love to have done, but I thought that was pushing it. But I did get to qualify as a helicopter pilot. Terrifying, but that was fun too. That was my last real flying tour, although I did get to fly as deputy commander in Strike Command. I still got to fly the odd trip in a Jaguar Harrier and in helicopter. So really, it was mainly MOD type stuff, but those amazingly privileged tours in Germany and at Strike Command when I could actually get my hands on the controls. With a guy in the back being very careful, of course, always.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And there's some great pictures in the books of, like, yeah, the flying you mentioned before. But we were chatting offline before, guys, like, who was watching this at the moment. And he's actually got a Gripen, or Black's got a Gripen in on his left. And you actually got to fly the Gripen, didn't you? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, after I'd left the Air Force, I managed to fly two airplanes I hadn't flown before. The F-15, which I flew when I was doing a bit of work for MOD. And then I was with BAE for a bit, which was British Aerospace, and then it merged with Marconi and became BAE Systems.
Yeah.
And they bought, it might have been 20%, I'm not sure, an interest in Saab. So we were keen to try and, quote, sell Saab to other people, Brazil, South Africa. And someone said, well, if you're going to get involved in this, you'd be going to fly it. So I flew out to Linköping in Sweden, and then had this amazing privilege of flying in the back seat of a two-seat Gripen, which was stunning, absolutely stunning. Not just the flying, Mike, hurtling around fjords and a part of the country.
It must have been amazing.
Yeah, fabulous fun. So I took my hat off. I mean, the Gripen was a delight to fly.
Absolutely. So, yeah, before we get into the personal questions, so how many years did you spend in the RAF and how many hours did you total, Black?
I spent about 36 years in the Air Force, and I must have flown about 3,600 hours, I suppose.
Wow.
More than 3,600, around that sort of figure. I could get my logbook out and show you, but about that.
We're going to ask some personal questions here, if you're happy to do that, Black.
It depends how personal they are,
of course. Of course. Yeah, so do you have any hobbies?
I do. It depends if you can call them hobbies. On the hobby side, I paint a bit, I write a bit. I could call skiing a hobby, sailing a hobby. They're interests. I do as much skiing as I possibly could, although my knees and my age are against me. Same with sailing. And I love music. I absolutely love music. And I suppose the other thing I do quite a lot of is research into World War II, I suppose. That's become more and more of an interest since I started writing books.
Yeah.
And World War II, Battle of Britain, I find that endlessly fascinating.
Absolutely. So this could be, again, like some people find it difficult, some people find it easy. Favorite aircraft you've flown?
Without a doubt, I spent 1 hour in a Sea Fury, and that was the best hour I've ever flown in an airplane.
Really?
The closest I ever came to flying what my father flew, I remember that forever. But if you ask me of all the others, what was my favorite, it would be the Hunter.
Hunter, wow, okay. I was expecting F4, but there you go. One you wish you could have flown in your career?
No question, Spitfire.
Spitfire. Wow. Did you ever get the chance to, the opportunity to jump in the BBMF or anything like that?
No. A friend of mine has just bought an aeroplane, a bit of a wreck at the moment, which he's rebuilding as a two-seater. So I've got this pleasure to come. It'll take a couple of years to get it there. But the thing about the BBMF, again, it's a privilege, and they haven't got any two-seaters. And the way someone like Cliff Spink was introduced to Spitfire flying was by being commanding officer at Coningsby. Probably the prime way of going to fly Spitfires.
Absolutely. So, Black, you've also wrote a new book called Fighters in the Blood, which you can see here. So could you tell us about this?
It came about in a sort of strange way. I was nagged after I stopped working full-time. What are you doing with yourself? You know, I wasn't doing very much. So the lady to whom the book is dedicated nagged me so much that eventually I put pen to paper. But it may sound strange having talked to you using the first person singular so much. I don't like writing I don't like reading books written in the first person. I find I'm less comfortable. So I was reluctant to start writing this book. And then I came across a bunch of memorabilia. My father had dictated what my brother typed out to be 60-odd pages of thoughts on what it was like to be a Spitfire pilot in World War II. He'd done that because when my brother had his first son, he begged my father to put his thoughts down on paper. And father said, well, I can probably do better than that. But they sat on tape for something like nearly 20 years before they were transcribed. I never really looked at them until I got them after I'd retired.
Yeah.
And then I found 300 plus letters that my father had written to my mother during the Second World War. I didn't ever want to read them, partly because I was reluctant to enter into a very personal relationship.
Of course, yeah.
So I decided to read 10 a day. And when I realized they were not sort of red hot stuff, they would genuinely.
Yeah, then you're okay. I could
do without invading my father's or my mother's privilege. I had those. I had all these notes from my father, and then I realized that a lot of things that happened to him had happened to me. So what I was able to do was to link his career to mine, and that was the way it came about. I was triggered by the RAF 100th anniversary. When I literally stood in the same place I had stood 60-odd years before with my father, when he climbed into a Spitfire for the first time since he was shot down, it all came together. I had the memorabilia, I had the letters, I had his notes, and I had spare time to sit and write. And like Jeffrey Wellham said about writing his book, and mine is nothing like Wellham's, which is a classic of his type, once I started writing, it just happened. I realized that's what father did, and I could just take chunks out of what he'd done and compare the two. And it was a cathartic experience. It wrote itself. Huge fun.
Did it come naturally to yourself, like writing?
If I say yes, that's going to sound wrong, but you have to bear in mind, Mike, that I spent 36 years in the Air Force doing a lot of writing. So, you know, you cultivate a style, and writing comes easily. I must have written tens of thousands of annual reports on people. So I was very much used to writing. So it was not difficult to write. And let's face it, on a computer, it's a lot easier than it was doing it before with pen and paper. So I hate to say this, I enjoyed writing when I was in the service, and I really enjoyed writing this book. And afterwards, I realized I didn't really do my father justice. So there's another one to come.
Well, I certainly, like, from what I've read, obviously I'm busy at the moment, but, like, from what I've read so far, Black, it's absolutely beautifully written and, really interesting. So tell us where we can find it online and yourself online.
This book here, he says, here's one I prepared earlier, which I'll put down again. That you can look up on Amazon, you can look it up on Pen and Sword, and you can get the best price. Or you can even come to me, and I will produce a dedicated signed copy. And my email, if you want it, is br@blackbornwells.com. Black as in the colour, born as in Jason, if you won't watch the movies, and Wells as in Somerset.
Absolutely.
br@blackbornwells.com.
Perfect. And if anyone has any trouble, you can drop me a line on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter if you want to get in contact with Black to get your book signed. But Black, what a privilege to talk to you today. I mean, we could talk for hours. Honestly, I could. But thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Mike, the pleasure's been mine. Thanks very much indeed.